Now, James chapter 5, verse 12 will be what we look at primarily today. And this is a difficult verse. You'll notice, first off, as you look at your version of the Bible, I don't know what it is, but typically a Bible will set paragraphs apart. And a lot of times in Bibles, you'll see just verse 12 set apart as a paragraph. And then above these paragraphs, they'll have a little title that's called a pericope. And typically, this is what Bibles do. Obviously, those divisions aren't inspired, of course. Not even verse divisions or chapter divisions are inspired, but translators and editors have broken the text up into what they consider to be the paragraph. And oftentimes, you find that they're broken up differently if you set out a lot of Bibles and look at the same passage next to one another. But the point is that they break them up into paragraphs, and then give each paragraph a title, and that's called a pericope. So when I study every week I do this, I look at the Greek and the English text, one of the first things I do after I get all the sentence divisions, and I look at where translators and editors have put the breaks. And then I either agree or disagree, you know, by looking at things. But verse 12 is really odd because most, if not all, but most translators put it by itself. You'll note that it, in many versions, it's just set apart as a single paragraph. Now, if you've ever taken an English class and you wrote a paper for an English teacher and you made a paragraph, one sentence, you got a lot of red on your paper. You don't do that. I don't know if you can do that in Greek or not. I haven't discovered that, but this is probably not the best way to break up this text, because what it does is it isolates verse 12 from the context in your mind and makes it very difficult to see its connection with what he's talking about. It just seems like it's almost thrown in there at a later date or something. But to avoid that, I am going to place verse 12 with verses 7 through 11. In verse 7, James gave us the command to be patient, brethren, and he used the example of the farmer. The farmer goes out, he sows his seed, and then he patiently expects and looks for the harvest. And we're to be patient like the farmer until the Lord comes. In the meantime, while we wait for him, we're to strengthen our hearts by studying Bible doctrine, advancing to spiritual maturity so that we bear fruit and are prepared for the any moment return of Christ. The text says he's standing at the door, that his coming is near, and those are phrases of imminence, that his coming can take place at any moment. We call this the pre-tribulational rapture because it will take place before the seven-year tribulation. The church will not go through the tribulation. She will not be protected through the tribulation or anything like that. She will be removed from planet Earth. So the church will not go through, and when we say that this is an imminent event, we mean that there are no prophetic events which must happen before the rapture. If there were prophetic events that must happen before, then the rapture would no longer be imminent. We would be simply waiting for that event to happen, and then we could say, now the rapture can happen. To illustrate this, let me use a man named Joel Rosenberg. Probably you may have heard of his name recently. He's written lots of books. He's over in the Middle East all the time. His most recent book is Epicenter. And there's been a little bit of confusion about what he believes regarding the timing of the rapture and whether it's an imminent event or not. In Epicenter, he says, for example, that the Battle of Gog and Magog, and I don't know if you're familiar with that battle, but it's a very important passage in Old Testament literature in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which describes a war that will come against Israel, primarily of nations composed in the north. We would say, most people say, Russia. That Russia will come into an alliance with Arab peoples, and they will try to destroy Israel. Now, he says in Epicenter that that battle must happen before the rapture. Then in his book, The Ezekiel Option, he places the Battle of Gog and Magog before the rapture. However, okay, so both of those, at least the first, would certainly deny imminence. If any event has to happen before, then the rapture cannot happen until that happens. Then, on his website, I went to look to find out about this, because he was asked straightforwardly if the battle of Gog and Magog must happen before the rapture. And he says, no, there is no prophetic event, I'm quoting now, that has to happen before Jesus snatches his church from the earth. That is, the Bible teaches us that we should be ready for Jesus to come for us at any moment. I fully believe that. But it should be noted with regard to this doctrine that while no major prophetic event has to happen before the rapture, that doesn't mean no such event will happen first. He goes on to say, it could happen. That is, the battle of Gog and Magog could happen before the rapture, but it doesn't have to. So I think he's in line with imminence teaching, and I use that as an example to point out to you what imminence really is, to catch it. And the point is that something may happen, some prophetic event may happen before the rapture takes place. In fact, people have argued that there already has been prophecy fulfilled in the restoration of Israel to her land as a nation. But nothing must happen before the rapture takes place. So it can happen at any moment, and that's what James is talking about. We should be ready for it at all times. The way to be ready. Now, how do I get ready? If I'm to be ready, I would like to know how to be ready. If I'm going to be in a wedding, I'd like to know what I must do beforehand to be ready for the wedding. So the way to be ready for the rapture is to advance to spiritual maturity, where we enter into fruit-bearing stage of Christianity. Not all believers, it may shock you, but not all believers advance to spiritual maturity. The way that you advance to spiritual maturity is by studying doctrine over years and years and years of consistency and obedience to the Scriptures. Those who do, Jesus said, are true disciples. He said they bear fruit, some 30, some 60, some 100-fold. Not all Christians do that. So we patiently expect His coming, and we spend our time studying Bible doctrine and applying Bible doctrine. And this includes the times when we undergo suffering and stress and frustration. When you get in a jam, it's not time to hear me or anybody else give you a great theological discourse. It's time to apply what you've been learning over a period of years. So then in verses 10 and 11, he gets into some Old Testament examples of suffering and patience. I mean, here's how you do it. Here's how you apply the doctrine in the midst of the trials. And he uses the prophets and Job. Now, these men, they faced horrific sufferings. Not just general suffering, but horrific sufferings. We looked at Job's last week and several of the prophets. And yet, when all was said and done, the outcome was that the Lord was full of compassion and mercy. Now, whether it be in this life or at the judgment seat of Christ, you'll see that no matter what you experienced in this life, no matter the horror, the pain, the suffering, and it's rampant out there, we all experience it to some degree. Paul says, no matter about all that, he says, that is momentary. He says that's light affliction. And he says it cannot compare to the eternal weight of glory to follow. It will be made right above and beyond, okay, either in this life or at the judgment seat of Christ. So God is, we saw in those examples of Job, He was full of compassion, He was merciful. And this, the words mean that He's not disconnected from your trials as you go through them in a cold, heartless way, just, come on, get through it. No. He's not detached in that sense. And He's not, He's very concerned with what you're going through. All of you. In all of your trials, in all of your sufferings. He is very concerned. Now, in that context, He gives us this command. Verse 12. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. Now, there's a textual issue at the end of the verse, whether it should read, fall under judgment or fall into hypocrisy. But the basic point is that in a suffering situation, what must take precedence is the control of the tongue. Control of your speech, control of your lips. We saw this with Job. After what I call round two, round one is chapter one, round two is chapter two. And after round two, what did Job's wife say to him? She said, "Curse God and die." And did Job do that? Did he follow her wisdom, advice? No. And the text says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So this verse is not disconnected from what has come before. It goes nicely with verses 7 through 11. And isn't it true that when we enter a trial, we become impatient, we lose self-control, and we tend to sin with our lips? With the proclivity toward sinful speech, this command takes precedence over all the others. Be quick to hear, be slow to speak in a time of trial, and this is reminiscent of the theme of the book, isn't it? In James 1, 19 through 20. But above all, now that is a preposition, the word above is a preposition pro. And normally, the word, when we add pro as a prefix, it means before. The prologue, the beginning words, or the before words. But here it carries the connotation of, you know, first of all. Here's what's first in importance. And the Greek lexicon says it's a marker of precedence and importance. In other words, what's most important? This is most important, what he's about to say. So we translate it, or they translate it, above all. Above all the other stuff, this needs to be taking precedence in a suffering situation like Job and the prophets. And it relates to our conduct in speech. What we say when we come under trial in a frustrating situation. It may be stress in your job. It may be pain because of physical ailment. It may be someone else's pain that we have to watch, a son or a daughter or a father or a brother or a sister or a friend. But no matter what the trial is, above all, we have to watch our speech. Remember, James is very concerned in this epistle with speech. He says in the theme of the letter, be slow to speak. And that's because in a suffering situation, we tend to lash out and get angry, and the tongue is a fire, and it blazes a path, you know, and sets the whole course of events in our life on fire, and everyone around us. But anger does not produce the righteousness of God. And if we just let the tongue go, if we just let it lash out, then we're going to commit sins of the tongue. It is so easy to sin with the tongue. We use it to curse God. That was what Job's wife wanted him to use his tongue for. We say, "Why are you doing this to me, God? Why are you letting this happen?" We use it to curse men when they cheat us or hurt us in some way. I wish that guy were dead. And we use it to blame others. Oh, that's not my fault. So-and-so did that. It's not me. No problems here. And sins of the tongue are a dime a dozen. And so we have to be very careful because the tongue tends to slip so quickly. We've all slipped and we've said things we shouldn't have said. Some people argue, "Well, hey, what I said was true." Well, just because something's true doesn't mean it's right to talk about it, that it's appropriate. We may say something that's true, but it may be malicious. We may say something that's true, but it's gossip. So just because something's true doesn't mean that we should vocalize it. The tongue is a sword. Sometimes we remember what someone said to us for years and years and years. And that's because the tongue is a sword and it cuts. And the wounds are deep and it takes years to heal. Sometimes people never heal from these things. Words can be so divisive. Chapter 3 is all about the tongue. In my Bible, the Pericope calls it the tongue is a fire. And what's remarkable about that chapter is that James says something is quite stupendous. He says, you can measure spiritual maturity by a man's speech. It's that definitive. If someone can't control their tongue, they are not spiritually mature. so James says in chapter 3, verse 2, we all stumble in many ways. That is, we all sin in many ways here. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. Not perfect, though. Why they would ever translate it, that I do not know. A teleos man. A mature man. He is a believer who has advanced to spiritual maturity. He's able to bridle his tongue. Now, sometimes we think of those who are quiet as simply passive. That's not the biblical view. All that it means when we are spiritually mature and able to bridle the tongue is that we know how to control that little instrument that can cause so much havoc in people's lives. So James says, above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath. He's saying that this is the way not to talk. Now, these are Jewish oath formulas. We have to understand a little Jewish background to understand this command not to swear by heaven and earth and all this. But for now, just know there's a way not to talk in a time of trial, and that there is a way to talk, and it's the end of the verse, but your yes is to be yes, your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. So we have how not to talk and how to talk in this verse when we get in a suffering situation. First, how not to talk. Do not swear. Now, this is a command to the brethren, fellow believers in Jesus Christ. James is clearly throughout written to believers, regenerate people. In other words, what we're saying is genuine believers can swear. They shouldn't, but they can, or else the command wouldn't be given. What does he mean by swear? Well, whatever he means, it's not appropriate, right? It's certainly sinful. It's the Greek word omnuo, O-M-N-U-O, omnuo. And it simply means this, to amend a statement by invoking a transcendent being. Saying something like, I swear to God, or I swear by the moon and the stars in the sky, or I swear by the Bible, or God, if you will get me out of this jam, I swear I'll do this for you. I promise this, or whatever, okay? Or some equivalent saying. So he's not talking about swearing in the sense of English slang. He's not saying don't cuss or whatever. Yes, obviously cussing would be a wrong response, but that's not what he's talking about here. This has to be understood in the first century Jewish context. So turn back to Matthew chapter 5. This goes back to Jewish oath formulas in Leviticus and Jewish culture. Once again, as you turn to Matthew 5, James is relying on things Jesus taught in this sermon. We call it Sermon on the Mount. There are several sections in James that I laid out for you in the very beginning of James that harken back to Matthew 5. Some people have called James the Sermon on the Mount for the church, because the Sermon on the Mount was directed toward Jewish people and the church hadn't even begun yet. At that time, when this was given by Christ, James was not a believer. James was the half-brother of Christ, but he didn't believe his half-brother was the Messiah until after the resurrection of Christ, his resurrection. But he may have been present when Jesus taught this on the northern shores of the Lake of Galilee. If you're going to Israel with us, you'll be able to stand there in this amphitheater-type setting, there on the northern shores of the Lake of Galilee. And he says this in Matthew 5:33. Jesus says, this seems to be the background of what James is saying. He says, again, verse 33, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. I love that description of the earth being the footstool. The earth to God is your ottoman in your living room. It's that small of an item. Verse 36, nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. It's pretty black and white here on the oath issue. Now, in verse 33, as we begin this section, Jesus is quoting from the law, isn't he? You see a quote there in verse 33, "You shall not make vows." That's Leviticus 19:12. And he says there, before he quotes that, he says, look, you have heard that the ancients were told this. In other words, you have these Jewish people who would go to the synagogue and they would sit and they would listen and they to what the Pharisees and the scribes had to say about these Old Testament texts. And he said, you've heard it said this. You've heard this since your childhood. And they've talked about Leviticus 19:12, and they've given you their interpretation of this text, which has to do with making vows. In verse 34, how does Jesus begin? He says, but I say to you. In other words, the scribes and the Pharisees had been teaching them their interpretation of the Old Testament law. But what they were teaching them was not the intended interpretation of the law. Now, how does Jesus know that the scribes and Pharisees were misinterpreting the law? Well, Jesus was the lawgiver. He didn't have any problems with the Old Testament law. He knew precisely what the intended meaning was. But the first century scribes and Pharisees were like modern day lawyers. They were technicians of the law, very slick, and they had numerous ways of getting around the law, we'd say. They'd find a loophole and, oh, that's an open window for another interpretation, and off they go. They were experts at making these slight distortions of the law. So Jesus' words, but I say to you, mean that what the scribes and Pharisees taught the Jewish people in the first century was wrong. And he's saying, let me tell you what it means. Jesus was a stickler for the right interpretation. Sometimes people get on to a Bible teacher who is a stickler for the right interpretation, but hey, let's do what Jesus did, right? And he was a stickler. You don't mess around and play with God's Word. And Jesus was not going to put up with it. So to see how they did this, turn over to Matthew 23. Here's how they dealt with the Old Testament laws on vows. Watch how these guys argued. It's like this. I've got this fine technical point here that keeps me from being condemned by the law. It's all this, I haven't violated anything. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm okay. Verse 16 of chapter 23. Woe to you blind guides who say, now this is the scribes and the Pharisees. They were the ones who said this. And he calls them blind, first of all. He comes directly with a judgment. Whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. See how they squeaked by on a technicality, or at least thought they did. Verse 18, and whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, oh, he's obligated. Another way to squeak by, so they thought. Now, does Jesus, the lawgiver, accept this interpretation? No. Look at verses 19 through 22. He says, you blind men, once again. He says, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? In other words, obviously they're equally important. Verse 20. Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by both the throne of God and by him who sits on it. See, he's saying you cannot get by on a technical point. They were guilty. They were blind. They were hypocrites. They were lawbreakers. But see, the human heart, my heart, your heart, everybody's heart, is sinful. It's the carnal heart. It is desperately wicked. Isaiah says, who can know it? Who can fathom this thing that is within us? So to escape the guilt of our sin, what we do is we like to reinterpret. Oh, the Bible can't be saying that. We've all said that. Don't play the game here and act like you haven't done it. Don't do it again now. We've all said that. It can't be saying that. What we're trying to do is wall off our conscience from absolute authority. We like to think that we're okay. That's what the scribes and the Pharisees were doing. They were saying, look at all my righteousness. I don't violate the law because I've got this slick line of reasoning over here. I didn't make a vow on the gold of the temple. I just made a vow on the temple itself. And so I'm out of this. All that was rationalizing. At the meantime, they like to accuse everybody else, but not me. I'm not guilty. I'm okay because I got a slick line of thought. But what have we done when we've done that? We have denied absolutes. We have become relativists. Because we said, that's wrong for everybody else, but not for me. And if it's wrong for everybody else except me, then it ceases to be an absolute because it doesn't apply to everybody. So relativism falls quickly out of our carnal nature. The carnal nature is a breeding ground for relativism. So Jesus is getting to the point that you can't do that. The law is absolute. You've violated it. You've made a vow and you've not kept your vow, so you're a lawbreaker. You're bankrupt before God. So the point here is that when you make a vow, you are obligating yourself to do something or say something. And if you fail at one point, you have violated the vow. There's no slick line of reasoning around it. Now let's ask a question. Is it wrong to make an oath, period? Is there ever a time when we could make an oath? That's a tough question. It seems so far as to what we've seen that the answer is no. You never make an oath. Ever, ever, ever. Yet, Exodus 22:11 commands occasions in a court of law when an oath should be taken. Exodus 22:11. And when Jesus taught Matthew 5, they were still under the law. It says Jesus was born under the law of a woman, Galatians 4:4. It says Matthew 10:4 that he fulfilled the law. He was born under the law, he lived under the law, and he fulfilled the law. When Jesus went to court under Caiaphas in Matthew 26:63 and 64, he was put under oath. Paul took an oath with four other men in Acts 21. So what we have to conclude, Jesus, Paul, and others put themselves under oaths at certain times, is the only conclusion can be this. There is no time to make an oath or a vow to anyone unless it is a legal issue. A court, a marriage, you know, things like that, right? Things that are recognized by a legal court or a legal system. Our character and speech in the world is supposed to be so trustworthy all the time that there's no need to amend any statement with, I promise, or I really mean it this time, or I vow, or I swear this is true. Our yes should be a simple yes, and our no should be a simple no. Now turn back to James 5:12. James is making an application of that principle I just taught you to a suffering situation. Remember, this is a suffering context when he says all this. He says the prophets, he says Job, they suffered, and yet remarkably, when you go back and you read the Job story, and it's 42 chapters, all the discussions this guy has with his friends, his psychologist, you know, the neighborhood psychologist, he never cursed God. The guy never sinned with his lips. It had to be frustrating because he's got his psychologist friends over here saying this. Now, Job, look, buddy, God is righteous. And if you're getting creamed down here, it's because you've done something unrighteous. Fess up, okay, to what you've done. That's why you're suffering. It's your personal sin. And yet Job kept insisting, no, guys, that's not it. I haven't done anything. And if you were with us in Sunday school last week, you realize that there are many more reasons that we suffer than simply personal sin. And we looked at 11 different reasons we might be suffering. Some direct, some indirect. Some directly caused by certain choices you make, cause, effect. Others more indirect. Obviously, when we get to the end of Job, we discover that the reason he was suffering had nothing to do with what he had done. it was a greater issue going on behind the scenes, and it had to deal with the resolution of the unseen angelic conflict. And so Job kept insisting, no, I haven't done anything. And you get 35 chapters of this back and forth. You've done something wrong, Job. God's punishing you for what you did. No, I haven't. Okay? Now, when someone does that to you and they won't leave you alone about it and they just keep harping and harping for 35 chapters of your life, we often get to the point where we say, look, I swear to God I didn't do that thing. Now leave me alone about it. And what's remarkable about the book of Job is he never did that. He simply let his yes be yes and his no be no. Now, he did want him to be quiet. He did want him to shut up. But he never went into that kind of a cursing mode, that swearing mode where we promise or swear or whatever. Because to swear or promise indicates that what you normally say can't be trusted. So, now the Jews like to swear by heaven or earth, James 5:12. They love to swear by heaven or earth. You may not do that, but they did. And the next phrase adds this, do not swear with any other oath or by any other oath. In other words, there are other formulas out there, other ways people confirm a statement to beef up that this time I really mean it. So this is something like a catch-all, any other formula that's equivalent. When I was a kid, we used to make deals, and you always had guys who'd break the deal, and someone would say, well, did you shake on it? And if you said no, then it really wasn't really a deal to begin with, right? Or you'd spit in your palm and shake your hand, you know, with this guy, and it's really gross stuff. But the bottom line is these characters are shady out there, so we need a little something more than yes or no. And it's ironic that we find this today all over the world, don't we? Whether it's legally or not. There's people have a tendency to lie. But Christians are to be honest people. You know, a few weeks ago I was at my optometrist. Don, I hope you don't mind if I use this story. I was talking to my optometrist, telling her about the story about what happened to his eye in this accident. And she says, well, you know, I have people come in here all the time and they say, I was wearing my safety glasses and this happened and I got this eye injury. And I just looked at her and said, well, do you think they might be lying? She just laughed. She just stopped and she said, well, I guess that is a possibility. I mean, how many people are going to come in and say, oh, yeah, I wasn't wearing my safety goggles or anything and talk to their optometrist that way? It's a good occasion to lie and say, oh, yeah, I was wearing them. But most people will just lie in many situations. So we expect people to almost amend statements with some kind of, I swear, or I promise, or I really mean this. But even then, it's got to the point where today, if someone does that, do we really know? I mean, who knows if this person is telling the truth or not? After a while, we tend to figure out who some of those compulsive liars are in our life, and we don't like to entrust information to them. But when you get in a suffering situation, the first tendency is to get angry, to blast everybody and go into a defensive mode. I didn't do this. It's not my fault. Don't blame me. And when that happens, what do people do? They say, I swear to God, I did not do that. I swear to God, I did not say that. Or some equivalent. Or when we get in a jam and we say, God, and I know you've never done this one, right? God, if you will just get me out of this situation, I will go into full-time ministry for you. I will travel the world. I will pray 24 hours a day. And, you know, it said that Martin Luther said this, you know, when he was in the lightning storm. I will become a monk, you know. People do this, and the point here, though, and we don't take it as seriously as they did in the Old Testament text and in the New Testament text, a vow is a very serious thing. In the Old Testament, vows were very, very serious. You were obligating yourself to do something, and any time you do that as a Christian, if you obligate yourself to do something, you are giving up freedom in Christ. Every time you obligate yourself, you're giving up freedom. And it's a very serious thing, as the verse goes on to suggest, if you break it, it's going to be judgment. You fall into judgment. So that's why, for example, when Peter Peter got in an adverse situation. Jesus said, you're going to deny me 3 times. Oh, no, Jesus. I'm loyal. Never do that. And yet, when we read in Mark 14:71, so this is a stressful situation by the third time. He's kind of dug himself a hole here. And it says, the lady asked him, you know, aren't you the Galilean? You are with this guy, right? And he says in Mark 14:71, but he began to put himself under a curse, Peter did, and swear, I do not know this man you are talking about. See, pressure, adversity leads us to fall into that. And he immediately realized what had happened and he began to weep. The seriousness of these oaths and vows that are often made. And that's what James is condemning. He says, do not say that. When we do those kinds of things, when we invoke some oath, what's the implication? The implication is that if I have to swear to God or I have to bargain with God or something, then I am not really a reliable person. When I tell my children, if you do that again, I'm going to spank you. And then they do it again and I don't spank them, what have I communicated to my child? That daddy is a liar. That I can't be trusted to do what I say I will do. And what does a child, this is how this fleshes out in families, this is where this leads to very quickly. The child begins to think this, well, mommy and daddy lied about spanking me. What else are they lying about? Maybe they're lying about Santa Claus. Maybe they're lying about God. Maybe they're lying that Jesus Christ died on the cross for my sins. And what do the children conclude? They conclude that mommy and daddy are not reliable sources of information. They can't be trusted. And that's where this leads to on a fundamental level. If you have to say, this time I really mean it, then that means that the first time you said it, you don't mean it. As Tom Constable says, James's wisdom amounts to this. We should never need to use an oath to prove that this time I really mean it. Instead, we should always really mean it. Fruitamom says, the necessity to support a statement with an oath demonstrates a lack of reliability. And what James is calling us to do is simply let our yes be yes and our no be no. Should be no need to bolster our speech by making promises, taking oaths, etc. in the normal course of life. In a court, yes. Normal course of life, no. Now those of you who've dug yourself a pit because of compulsive lying over years, you're going to want to say, well, this time I really mean it. I swear. No, it's not going to work. You're not supposed to do that. You're going to have to build yourself a track record of trustworthiness before people will begin to trust you again. And it will take time because you have dug a hole for yourself. Well, why are we supposed to just let it be a simple yes or no? The end of verse 12 says, so that you may not fall under judgment. Now that would seem to tie it in with the previous verses because the previous verses says the judge is at the door. And obviously if the judge is there, what does he carry out? He carries out a judgment. That verb fall there, fall under judgment, is a prohibitive subjunctive. And what that means is this. When you take an oath or amend your speech, you begin immediately to start to fall under judgment. In the sense that we humans are so fickle that we might break an oath at any moment. I never, hardly ever make them. I can't remember the last time I ever made one because I know that I am fickle. And I will abandon it at some point. I will fall short. So it's best not to make them at all. Another reading of the text at the close of the verse says, so that you may not fall into hypocrisy, in which case it's the fact that you're being very disingenuous, whatever you're doing or saying. You say something for the moment, but then you don't follow through with it. Either way, it's a sin, and it's very serious. If you make a vow, you better fulfill it. But the New Testament is very clear. Don't do it unless you are in a legal situation, a court of law, a marriage, something like that. Okay, so just keep in mind verses 7 through 12 are a paragraph. This is all related to enduring trials with patience, not losing control of our tongues, But the only way to get to that point is to advance to spiritual maturity by the consistent study of Bible doctrine and the application of known truths. Next time is Christmas, but the time after that, because we'll have something on the birth of Christ next week, we'll get into the second highly controversial passage in James. It's chapter 5, verse 13 through 18. And we'll deal with verse 14, which has led believers into innumerable oddities, because it says, "Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord." So we'll get into what kind of sickness is being referred to here. Is it a physical sickness or is it a spiritual sickness? What's the oil and all of that? So until next time, let's close with a word of prayer.